Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in the listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Janitha, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Connect workshop, Progress in the Treatment of Renal Cell Cancer. This is an important program. It's one that I know many of you have asked us to offer throughout the year, and you're going to hear a lot of information today. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer-related organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 668 participants, so there's a lot of you on the call today, and you come from all over the United States. You come from large cities and smaller cities and rural and frontier communities and suburban areas as well, and we also have international participants from Africa, Australia, Belgium, Canada, Jamaica, Korea, the Philippines, the United Arab Emirates, and the United Kingdom. So you really are truly a global audience, and a group of information seekers as well. Now, today's program was made possible through an educational grant from Pfizer Oncology, and I really want to thank them for their support of the program. I would like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information, there's an outline of what our speakers will be covering, and there also is information about all of the different collaborating organizations, their email addresses, their websites, their toll-free numbers. And there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment and complete the evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the programs that you would like us to offer? Indeed, today's program is one that many of you have requested over time, and we very much try to implement the programs that you suggest. So if there's a topic that you would like us to offer as a Connect workshop, please let me know, and we will fill out the evaluation form, and we will very much try to implement your suggestions. We really turn to each of you for those recommendations to really make the programs relevant to meet your needs. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to introduce our first speaker is Dr. Eric Jonasch. He's Associate Professor of Medicine, Department of Genitourinary Medical Oncology, Director of VHL Clinical Center, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. Dr. Jonasch is going to address an overview of renal cell cancer. He's going to provide a current standard of care, new treatment approaches, and the importance of communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Jonasch.
Thank you very much, Dr. Messner, and it's a real privilege to be able to speak today to this group of individuals. As Dr. Messner mentioned, I'm going to cover four major topics. The first is going to be a broad overview of renal cell carcinoma. I'm then going to talk about the current standards of care for this disease, new treatment approaches that are coming down the pipeline, and also the importance of communicating with your healthcare team. So first, the overview of kidney cancer. Approximately 50,000 individuals are diagnosed with cancers of the kidney and the renal pelvis every year in the United States. And to put that into perspective, there's about 200,000 individuals who are diagnosed with lung cancer every year in the USA. But on the other end of the spectrum, the cancer that Lance Armstrong had, testicular cancer, there's only about 8,000 cases of that per year. So we are talking about a disease that's certainly not the least common, but it's not the most common. And it comprises about 3% of adult cancers. The current treatment algorithm for this disease is best discussed if we think of it by stage. And what stages are really are ways for both the doctors and the patients to better understand where exactly this cancer is, how big it is, and also to some degree how it affects the way a patient deals with it. A stage one tumor is a fairly small tumor that's confined to the kidney, measuring about 7 centimeters in size, which is about 2.5 inches. And then stage 2 disease is larger but within the kidney still, meaning that it is confined within the capsule of the kidney. A stage 3 tumor is still within the kidney to some degree, but it's starting to demonstrate the ability to grow outside of there, either through the vein that serves the kidney or around into the tissues around the kidney itself. And then stage 4 means either a tumor that's very large with a large number of lymph nodes or a larger number of lymph nodes right around the kidney or having spread to other organs in the body. Treatment for stage 1, 2, and 3, which are the tumors that essentially are still confined to the kidney or about to start growing outside of the kidney, is surgery. So a urologic oncologist, a surgical individual, will then remove this tumor. And at this point in time, in 2011, the standard of care, the best treatment that we offer at this point in time, is careful observation for this these three stages. There have been some research studies looking at medications to decrease the risk of recurrence, and there are some of these studies that are currently underway, one with one of the newer drugs called Votrient, which is opening, and there's also another trial that's going to be opening looking at a drug called Afinitor or Everolimus. These are important trials, and I encourage anyone who is in a position where they are eligible for those trials to consider participation. And for those individuals who do not participate in those trials and have stage 1, 2, or 3 kidney cancer, our recommendations are close observation with CT scans. If you have stage 4 kidney cancer, which means, generally speaking, that it has spread beyond the kidney itself to other organs in the body, there are three major treatment categories. The first are immunotherapies, of which interleukin-2 has been Food and Drug Administration approved. That's the regulatory body that approves the medications in the United States for use in kidney cancer. The other major classes are anti-angiogenic or blood vessel starving types of drugs, of which there are 4 that have been FDA approved. One is sunitinib or Sutent. The other is Nexavar or Sorafenib. The third is Votrient or Pazopanib. And the fourth is Bevacizumab or Avastin. The next category are mTOR inhibitors, M-T-O-R inhibitors, of which there are 2 that have been Food and Drug Administration approved. The first is called Torisel or Temsirolimus, and the other is called Afinitor or Everolimus. In general, the discussion with your treating doctor will help determine which of these drugs is going to be best for your particular situation. Interleukin-2 can be given to individuals in general who have very good overall organ function, who are younger, and who have clear cell kidney cancer. I should comment right now that there are 3 major types of kidney cancer types that you can get. One is clear cell, one is papillary, and one is chromophobe. And for interleukin-2 use, we would want to see clear cell. The anti-angiogenic or blood vessel starving drugs, of which I mentioned there are 4, Sutent, Nexavar, Votrient, and Avastin, are generally used also for people who have a clear cell and can also be considered in individuals who have other histologies, mainly in clinical trials. The last class of drugs, the mTOR inhibitors, have been shown both in people who have not received prior therapy and received subsequent therapy to be of value, and mainly in individuals who have what we call poorer risk features. These are factors that include anemia, high calcium level, a shorter time to diagnosis from diagnosis to treatment, and a few other factors. And if your doctor decides that you have these what are so-called poor risk features, then maybe an mTOR inhibitor like Torsel would be an appropriate first step. With regards to new treatment approaches, there are some new drugs that are currently under investigation that may become new therapies for kidney cancer at some point in the next several years. These include newer immune-modulating treatments, including antibodies, which are essentially things that our body produce against particular proteins, which will regulate the immune system in novel ways. And there are anti-CTLA-4 antibodies and anti-PD-1 antibodies. These are jargonish descriptions for these types of therapies, but they are coming into clinical investigation and maybe will be of value at some point in the future. There are also new blood vessel starving drugs, including axitinib and tivozanib. These drugs are similar to Sutent, Nexavar, Votrient, as I had described before, but are a newer generation, and we are going to be hearing more about these in the next year or so. Lastly, there are PI3 kinase inhibitors. Again, this is a term that really describes a particular protein within the cell and a pathway, and these inhibitors block this particular pathway, which happens to be upregulated in certain kidney tumors. And there are drugs including MK2206, which is now currently in research trials, and others like it that are being tested. Lastly, I want to talk about communication. All of these drugs and all of these procedures that I've talked about clearly are important to discuss with your healthcare team. It's important that when you are thinking about surgery, that you talk about the options of the types of surgery that are available. You can do an open surgery where you have a larger incision. You can do a laparoscopic or robotic surgery where there's a smaller incision in the abdomen. And you can also do types of surgeries where there's only a partial removal of the tumor, but not of the kidney. When you're on a medication for metastatic or stage 4 cancer, it's extremely important that you learn early on in your treatment who to contact and how to contact them when you're on these medicines. We find that the patients that are able to communicate sooner rather than later if they're having any problems with their treatments are the ones who do better in the long run. Most of the therapies that we give are given over a longer period of time, and so it's really important that we make sure your body remains strong and healthy while you're on these drugs, that you don't get beaten up by the drugs, that you can stay on them longer, because in the end, that's really going to benefit you. So I'd like to thank everyone for listening, and I'd like to pass on to Dr. Messner.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Yonesh, for just a very comprehensive and very informative presentation, and really a lot of information for everybody, and really covering such key issues in really such a compassionate way as well. So thank you. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. David McDermott, and Dr. McDermott is Clinical Director, Biologic Therapy Program, Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, Assistant Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. McDermott is going to address the importance of clinical trials, including review of the phases of clinical trials. He's going to talk about how research contributes to treatment options, managing side effects and pain, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. McDermott.
Thank you, Carolyn, and it's an honor to be here, and I hope I can communicate some useful information today. Dr. Yonesh did an excellent job describing the progress that's being made in the field of kidney cancer research. I think, while I'm biased, obviously, I think it's fairly safe to say that there's been no area in the field of cancer therapy that's seen more progress in the last 5 or 6 years than the treatment of advanced kidney cancer. It's largely due to clinical trials and people like yourselves listening on the call who have participated in those trials that helped make this progress that hopefully you will benefit from and almost certainly patients in the future will benefit from. And it's through that research that we can continue to make gains. But we obviously need to do more work. Dr. Yonash described 6 new drugs approved in the last 5 years, but we, while we're making gains, while we're helping people live longer, while we're helping them live better lives, we need to do more. So a little bit about clinical trials to start, because I was asked to talk about that. One of the questions I get from patients when they come to see us here at Beth Israel Deaconess is, why should I participate in a clinical trial? They're often referred from the community to consider clinical trials, and they wonder why they should do it. Well, for sure, one thing that you're doing when you're participating in clinical trials is you're helping future people who may contract this disease. There's no question about that. And some people find that rewarding and important. I certainly think it's important. I think one of the other issues, though, is what are you doing for yourself if you participate in clinical trials? Because it's obviously much more of a commitment oftentimes to participate in trials. You have to travel to the center where the trial is ongoing, which sometimes can be difficult. You're often asked to make more visits than you might otherwise be. One of the questions people ask is, why should I do this? I would try to make several answers to those questions. One, we believe that it's considering clinical trials is giving you access to cutting-edge therapies. In the past, maybe 10 years ago, many clinical trials produce very negative results in cancer medicine. But more and more these days, the newer therapies are actually real improvements on older ones. Way to access them sooner is to consider clinical trials. So I would say, one argument for trials is you get cutting-edge therapies. They're not for everyone, but they should at least be considered. Another possible argument for clinical trials is, could the care be better? Could the results be better in a clinical trial? And while that's hard to prove, and I'm obviously biased with my opinions, you are being followed very closely on clinical trials and being scrutinized very carefully, both for side effects and for positive or negative effects of positive effects of the drug on your tumor. You're being watched like a hawk, often by a team of not only physicians, but nurses and data managers, all of whom are focused and spend most of their day focusing on your particular type of cancer. So you do get extra scrutiny, and for folks who like that feeling, sometimes that can be a reassuring, and in some cases probably might lead to better outcomes. I think while there's no question that clinical trials have improved outcomes over the last 10 years, one of the other important things I would mention is that if you're going to consider clinical trials, the sooner you consider them, the better, for two reasons. One, because if you've had several prior treatments, you're often a little bit more limited in the types of trials that you can enroll on, number one. Number two, Dr. Yonash mentioned 6 FDA-approved drugs for kidney cancer. If you have advanced disease, you can receive those treatments at any point in your care. But I often encourage people to expand their options by considering clinical trials and saving those FDA-approved drugs for when clinical trials do not seem appropriate. It increases your options, and I think that's a key sort of message to get across. The more options you have, it's likely the longer you're going to live with your disease. So a few, and if you're interested in clinical trials, one of the, as Dr. Yonash mentioned, communication is the key. Asking your doctor early about it is important. There are also resources on the Internet, places to go where you can learn about clinical trials. One very good resource is clinicaltrials.gov, www.clinicaltrials.gov. It's the National Cancer Institute website that not only lists the clinical trials that might be appropriate to you, but also lists their locations so targeting you to the trials that are closest to your area. Also, the Kidney Cancer Association has good resources for people interested in clinical trials. a little bit sort of more specifically about the types of clinical trials, they generally fall into three major categories. Phase one clinical trials mainly focus on drug safety, typically trying to figure out what are the side effects of a drug, what's the proper dose, what's the proper schedule of a treatment. In the past, those have not generally been in the interests of most people living with cancer because they're mainly focused on side effects of treatment, not necessarily effectiveness of treatment. But over the last several years, those even phase one trials can sometimes be potentially to the benefit of patients, in part because of two things. One, we're getting more specific in our phase one trials in that we are targeting them to specific forms of cancer as opposed to all cancers. 5 or 10 years ago, most of phase one trials were tested in any form of cancer. Nowadays, there are many phase one trials that are being specifically targeted for certain cancers. I can think of one particularly in kidney cancer that's ongoing right now. There are several with a drug called XL184 where it's being focused mostly on kidney cancer patients because there's reason to believe this drug might be most active in kidney cancer patients. So the trials are being more focused, even in phase one. Also, the trials are in phase one are often having what are called dose expansion groups, meaning when they reach the maximum tolerated dose, often phase one trials are enrolling a larger number of patients just to see how active the dose is. So if you enroll at the proper time in a phase one trial, you might be getting the safest, most active dose of the drug. So while we generally don't consider phase one trials right away for patients, they are appropriate for many patients, particularly those patients who've had multiple prior treatments. The next type of clinical trial is what's called a phase two trial, and what this mainly focuses on is we have the dose by the time the drug gets to phase two, we have the schedule. Now the question is how effective is the drug? And for many patients, these trials are the most appealing because they're focused on one form of cancer generally. And they're focused, everyone gets the same dose. Everyone gets the same schedule. There's no randomization, which we'll talk about. There are no placebos involved. And the goal is effectiveness of treatment. So phase two trials are often, very interesting ones. Dr. Yonash mentioned one interesting one that should open later this summer with a new form of immunotherapy, an agent called MDX-1106, which is what's called a PD-1 antibody, which he was talking about briefly. That's an example of a phase two trial where everyone is going to get the drug in question, and the goal will be to see how effective the drug is. Phase three trials are ones that you most commonly read about in the newspaper. These are trials that compare two different treatments, usually comparing the standard of care to a newer therapy. So these trials are often what's called randomized, meaning a computer assigns a patient one trial or the other, and the physician and the patient don't have any influence over that decision. Now, the concept of randomization can be sort of off-putting and can be something that is challenging as a concept, but it's something you should discuss with your physician closely. Do I want to be in a situation where I'm not sure what treatment I might get? And there are pluses and minuses to participating in a randomized trial. Oftentimes, you're gaining potential access to a newer therapy, which you hope is better, but you're not guaranteeing that access. So that requires a discussion. Also, placebo-controlled trials or blinded studies are concerning for many patients. So you want to ask those questions: Is this trial might I get a placebo if I enter this trial? Most cancer trials these days, particularly in kidney cancer, are not placebo-controlled. So that isn't most patients are worried that this might be something that they might have to deal with, but it's typically not something in reality that is happening. It's usually comparing a standard treatment with something we hope is a better treatment. So I hope that helps sort of describe the importance of clinical trials and the different types of clinical trials. And what I would try to emphasize to all of you is that explore your options, talk to your clinicians about your options, and consider them earlier in your course of treatment to expand your options and to see if it's appropriate for you. And it never hurts to learn about your options and then make your decision with your by yourself and with your support team. Moving quickly on to toxicity management, side effect management, the good news is we have a lot of new therapies. The downside of these therapies is they often have annoying side effects, and you need to stay on the treatment for the treatments to work, meaning they require chronic, ongoing therapy. So managing side effects, as Dr. Yonesh was pointing out, is essential to keeping the positive effects of the drug ongoing. The effects are important, but they are only happening if you're on treatment. So a few brief words about side effect management. I think one of the important things before you start a treatment is you want to get a better sense of, you know, how can I improve the outcome with treatment? And one of the things I like to talk to about the patients about are, what are your goals with treatment? Trying to define those ahead of time. Do you want treatment at any cost, or do you want to improve quality of life as much as possible, so you want to hold off on treatment until you absolutely need it? So that's an important discussion to have with your family, but also with your physician. You know, do I need treatment right away? What are the goals of this approach? Another important thing to understand before you start is how best can I stay on the regimen? How best can I sort of adhere to the plan that the doctor is prescribing? And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. Things that you probably need to know before you start any treatment is, how does the drug work? You know, what are the side effects? What can I expect? When can I expect it? What can I do if something occurs? You know, what are going to be my schedule of visits and treatment? You know, when am I coming in? When am I going to be seen? What other medications might I need to take when I'm on a treatment? All of those are important issues to get up front to help you to stay on the current treatment. There's also information your team needs about you that you need to share with them to improve your outcomes. Things like your history, your health history. What are oftentimes other medical issues can make treatment more challenging? You know, what are the medications that you're on, particularly supplements like herbal remedies, for example? What else am I taking that might interact with medications that might enhance side effects? Those things need to be out on the table early on. What are my other allergies? Also things in your social life, for example, like who lives with you? What's your support group? Getting that information across, who's the team that's caring for you, will help your clinician manage your case. And also talking about upfront things like your insurance. Can my insurance cover this? These drugs are ridiculously expensive for the most part, and there are often gaps in people's coverage. Getting that information up front is very important, and finding out what other resources exist to help fill in those gaps is important. And the more you communicate that with your physician, the better. Things that can improve your sticking on a regimen is, you know, writing down the schedule, you know, things, simple things like pill boxes. You know, we talked about communication, but there's a lot of things that one can do to stay on the treatment regimen. But the most important thing I want to get across is the goal should be to keep you on the most you can tolerate for the longest period of time. The goal should not be to keep you on the most amount of treatment to the point where you get too sick, that your quality of life is reduced. The goal, oftentimes people need to take breaks from treatment. That's okay. Oftentimes people need to have their dose reduced. That's okay too. It's important not to push yourself too hard so that you can no longer tolerate any treatment, or you have to come off a treatment entirely. So that's why we get back to, what are the goals of treatment? What's your focus as it relates to quality of life? For specific side effects, there's too many to talk about in general, but just briefly, because I've already gone over the time that I had, I would say the hardest one oftentimes to manage is fatigue, and there's not a lot of great medical therapies for fatigue, but one important thing managing fatigue is exercise. You know, it doesn't have to be strenuous exercise, but the more you can exercise, the more you can get out and walk and do things, often I find my patients have less fatigue. Improving your sleep patterns is obviously important. Building in rest periods during the day can certainly help, something you might not have wanted to do. Taking naps and things like that can make a huge difference in managing fatigue. Skin side effects also can be very annoying with many of these treatments. There are many different creams that can work to improve these side effects in the skin. They should be started before you start treatment, continued often during breaks of treatment. There are things like avoiding hot showers, that can help with skin toxicity and the like. There's a lot of other stuff that can be done. In general, another good resource for managing side effects is, once again, the Kidney Cancer Association website that I mentioned before has a lot of information about side effect management. And the list goes on, and I don't have too much time to talk about it, but the key is to sort of know what you're getting into before you do it, so that you know what the options are. What are the treatments? Many of the side effects, like, for example, upset stomach or diarrhea, can be managed with medications, often over-the-counter medications. The more you know about these, the better that you will do with treatment. In general, and the same can be said for pain management. Pain is one of the more difficult, debilitating outcomes of cancer. It can be managed much more effectively in 2011 than it could just 10 years ago. The importance there is getting expert help and communicating with your team. There's often, at many centers, we often have people who focus just on managing side effects and just on managing pain. They can be brought into your care early on, and they often make a big difference in outcome. Scheduling, tracking what you're doing to manage your pain is also important, checking what works, adjusting medications accordingly. But if your focus is quality of life, keeping your pain under control is so important in that regard, chronic pain affects sleep, it affects appetite, it affects energy, it affects the way you communicate with your family members. There's a lot that we can do, but it needs to be addressed aggressively, and you need to be very upfront about your symptoms with your care team. And in general, most of what I said sort of folds into all these to quality of life, and the goal here should be to be maximizing your quality of life. I think sometimes that means, to me, is not starting treatment right away. If you don't have cancer that's causing symptoms, you should ask your physician, do I need to start treatment right now? Can I wait? Oftentimes that will, and then save treatment options for when you truly need them. That's something to be, something to consider. And during that time when you're off treatment, your quality of life will often be quite good. You won't have to manage the side effects. So that's a lot. I've gone over my time, and I'm glad to take any questions. I hope that was helpful.
Well, this is incredibly helpful, and I have to say, Dr. McDermott, this is very encyclopedic, lots of information, but presented in a very understandable way, and you covered a lot of different issues that are so important for everybody on this call to hear. So I know that there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, and thank you very much. Just excellent. And our next speaker is Joan Elizondo, and Joan is a senior clinical dietitian at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, and she is going to address nutritional concerns and tips and eating hints. I'm going to turn the program over to Joan.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, for that warm welcome and for allowing me to discuss the nutrition concerns and tips for individuals with renal cell cancer. Today, we are going to discuss ways to minimize some of the side effects of treatment through nutrition, because good nutrition is such an important part of your cancer treatment. This will include suggestions on how to manage loss of appetite, ways to help maintain your body weight, tips for changes of taste, and nutritional ways to manage diarrhea. Some tips for losses of appetite would be, you might want to try eating 6 to 8 smaller, more frequent meals or snack throughout the day. You may also want to try limiting greasy, fried, or high-fat foods, which may be difficult to digest. Also, you want to take advantages of the times you're the hungriest. So if you're hungrier in the morning, eat a little bit more then. Also, you want to make your meals enjoyable and in a pleasant atmosphere with friends and or family. You want to try nutritional supplements, milkshakes, or smoothies. You may also want to keep snacks available with you, whether you're at home or out doing errands. Some high-calorie snack ideas may include peanut butter with crackers or toast, graham crackers with milk, cheese and crackers, instant breakfast with milk, maybe a bagel with cream cheese, some dried fruit and nuts, half a sandwich with fruit, or maybe some nutritional supplements such as Ensure, Boost, or Carnation Instant Breakfast. Some ways to help maintain your body weight, especially when you're not eating well, you may want to try what we call power packing your foods. So your goal is to try to get as many calories as you can in a small amount of food. You can do this by choosing foods high in calories such as avocados, cheese, unsalted nuts, nut butters, dried fruit, fresh fruit, oil, granola, or honey. So an example would be instead of having a piece of dry toast, you may want to try adding peanut butter and honey or some cheese to help add calories. Also, you can try eating small, frequent meals and keep snacks around the house. You might want to try to buy snacks or convenient foods such as granola bars, fruit or fruit juices, trail mix, peanut butter and crackers, cheese and crackers, soup, dry cereal, plain yogurt are just a few examples. You may want to use caution with some of these foods because if you start having problems with your kidney function, you may need to limit foods high in protein or potassium. You can also ask your medical team for a consultation with your dietitian to set up a meal that is right for you. Some tips for changes of taste may include you might want to try rinsing out your mouth with a baking soda solution. This would be 1/4 teaspoon of baking soda with 4 ounces of water before eating to help cleanse out your mouth of any unpleasant tastes. You want to make sure you drink adequate fluids. You can flavor water with mint, lemon, cucumbers, or fruit. Make sure to ask your medical team what the appropriate amount of liquids is right for you since it varies from person to person. You may also want to try chewing sugar-free gum, peppermints, or lemon drops. You can try, if your food start tasting a little metallic, you can use plastic utensils and avoid canned foods. If foods are tasting too sweet, you can try increasing salty or tart flavors, such as lemon, citrus, or vinegar. And if foods are tasting too salty or bitter, you can increase the sweeter flavors of foods. You can try agave nectar, honey, or maple syrup. Lastly, we'll discuss ways to manage diarrhea. Foods which may irritate your bowels a little bit may include foods high in fiber. Some examples of these would be peas, beans, broccoli, nuts, seeds, pears. Also, foods high in fat, such as fried foods, rich desserts such as pies, cakes, and ice cream, or butter. And you may want to try to limit caffeine or spicy foods, which can cause foods to move through your intestines more quickly. Also, milk or other dairy products may make your diarrhea worse. So you may want to try limiting to about half a cup serving per meal or try lactose-free foods like soy milk, almond milk, or lactate milk. Some people do tolerate yogurt and hard cheeses, so you can try these and see if you tolerate them. Some hot fluids make diarrhea worse, so you might want to wait until they cool off to room temperature. And you want to make sure you drink plenty of fluids to maintain your hydration. And you may also want to try drinking the fluids between meals. Remember that everybody is different, so listen to your body and ask for help with your nutrition if you need it. Thank you so much and for inviting me today and for talking to everybody. I hope this was helpful to some of you, and I wish you all a wonderful, healthy day. Thank you.
Well, Ashley, thank you very much, Joan, for these wonderful tips and suggestions, and I think that these will be very helpful to people in the audience in terms of just thinking of things that one can eat and things to do. So you've given us a tip on everything, and I think there'll probably be questions for you as well during the Q&A. And I'm going to thank all of our speakers. You've just been terrific, and I'm going to ask now Trinitha to bring all of our speakers on board, and I'm going to ask Trinitha to explain to you how to queue up to ask questions of our speakers. And the other thing is, if for some reason, because there are so many of you on the call, if we don't get to answer your question, please do call Cancer Care at the end of the call at 1-800-813-HOPE, and our staff are here to answer your questions and address your concerns. So I'm going to ask Trinita to just explain to you how to queue up for questions, and we'll let the questions begin. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered, or if you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Again, ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone.
And while we're waiting for questions, there is a question from one of our online participants. The question is that the person is saying that I'm interested in any new drugs available for someone with renal cell cancer who has tried all the FDA-approved drugs and is now on chemotherapy. So I'm going to ask Dr. McDermott if you could address that question.
Right. It's a little hard to address it specifically without knowing all the details of the number of prior treatments, but I think this person brings up a point that I was making earlier, which is if you're interested in clinical trials, it's often better to ask these questions earlier on in your condition, in part because oftentimes the number of prior treatments that someone has received will limit their clinical trials options. For example, most phase 3 trials will often require patients to have had either no prior treatment or maybe one prior treatment before they can enter a phase 3 trial. So for someone who's received all of the FDA-approved drugs, which may be 5 or 6 different medications, many trials will not be eligible for. That being said, it sort of brings up my other point, which was that phase 1 trials often do not limit people's options as far as prior therapies. Now, in the past, many people would not have considered phase 1 trials because they weren't very specific, say, to kidney cancer, or they may not contain active doses of treatment, and all those concerns are legitimate. But nowadays, there are phase 1 trials that are specific for kidney cancer, number one, and number two, they're often containing active doses of treatment, particularly if they've been open for a while and they've accrued some patients. So the important thing here is to talk to your physician and get some guidance and talk about where there are trials open in your area that you can be referred to and ask for a second opinion and go and see a person doing kidney cancer clinical trials in your neck of the woods and see what the options are and have that person as your advocate trying to sort out these decisions.
Excellent. And Dr. Yonash, would you like to add anything to that?
I'd like to echo what Dr. McDermott was saying. The number of prior therapies does alter eligibility, but the exciting thing about the new drugs that are becoming available for cancer in general is that the probability of finding something in the phase 1 clinical trials program that may provide some value has increased. So I would encourage all patients to consider participation in clinical trials. And clinical trial programs that run phase 1 trials are also interested in making sure that there is a good fit with the person's disease, kidney cancer in this case, and the particular trial.
Excellent. Thank you. And there is another question from one of our online participants, and that question really has to do with the fatigue. They're experiencing a lot of fatigue, and I wondered if Dr. McDermott could say a bit more about just in terms of, and this would be a general, of course, response to this question for everyone to help everyone, but just in terms of fatigue, it can be obviously a very difficult side effect, and other things that people should discuss with their healthcare team and kind of explore in terms of dealing with this with fatigue.
So yes, a common problem with many of these medications, and one that's very hard to treat. So it's not my advice is not earth-shattering, and necessarily I don't have any particular great advice that will definitely solve the problem. But as I mentioned before, things that have worked for other folks include increasing their exercise, which may sound ridiculous when you're exhausted, but it's certainly something that helps people with fatigue. We talked about improving sleep patterns. We talked about taking breaks during the day and scheduling your day around times when you're particularly tired. But one of the things I didn't mention, which is something to consider, is many people require a dose reduction or a break in treatment. And there's nothing, oftentimes, unless you have active symptoms of your cancer, that's something that should be considered, I would think, earlier for many people. Because by increasing the break time, as long as the cancer doesn't grow during those breaks, you can often dramatically improve fatigue. It's very hard to treat in many patients without considering either dose lowering or a schedule adjustment to increase breaks between treatment cycles. And I think they're also switching to different medications can make a difference. And there are a few medications that help people who can't take breaks, say, from treatment, and you can't have a dose reduction. There are sometimes stimulant medicines that will help with the fatigue. They're not ideal. They have their own side effects. But medications like Provigil, for example, and Adderall, for example, are things that some of my patients have taken and have helped them through their low periods. But the key to this is communicating how difficult you're feeling with your physician and asking him or her, can I have a break? Do I need this dose? Can I consider a different schedule of treatment? Would that be reasonable? Because it's oftentimes that's what's required to get at this particularly annoying side effect.
Excellent. This actually, I appreciate these are very helpful tips. And Dr. Jonasz, would you like to add anything to this as well?
I agree with Dr. McDermott's comments. What I tell my patients is that these therapies that we are giving, mostly the blood vessel starving or anti-angiogenic therapies, the pill form therapies, the treatment schedule and the way that it's given the continuity or the dosing is not really like a string of pearls that if you were to stop or take a break during that cycle of therapy that all of a sudden everything's going to fall apart and it's going to completely ruin the cycle. It's quite the opposite. The way we look at it is that the effect of the treatment on the cancer happens quite a bit quicker than the effect of the treatment on the body itself. And what you want to do is you want to treat the cancer but not get the dosing of the drug to the point where the normal body tissues start getting hurt. And that includes fatigue, and that includes the mouth soreness and the hand-foot problems. And finding a schedule that works for a particular individual is the key point here, and that comes back to the communication between the doctor, the nursing staff, and the healthcare team and the nutrition team to make sure that you come up with something that's really customized to that particular individual.
Thank you, and I'm going to ask Joan if she'd like to comment on this as well, because we really do have a multidisciplinary team here. So, John, I wonder if you wanted to comment on just the issues of just whether when people come to you and they're having difficulty perhaps eating and are feeling sort of tired and don't have the energy to prepare food and what your thoughts are about that.
Well, a lot of times when my patients tell me about fatigue, I will, do suggestions such as, convenient foods and snacks, make sure they're getting the adequate hydration and nutrition, because sometimes the loss of appetite, and because they're just so tired that they don't really even feel like eating. So I really try to tell them maybe to try to focus on maybe setting an alarm every couple of hours so they can eat, maybe even if it's just a bite of food, to get those calories in, because without the right nutrition or without the right calories and fluids, they're gonna be even more tired because they're not getting all those. So, we do talk about, different things, what they like, what you don't like, and try to set up a plan that would be appropriate for them on foods that they like and foods that maybe their neighbors or their friends could make for them to help them out. And, you know, don't be scared to ask your friends and neighbors and family to help you and make some dishes for you, because most of the time they want to do something for you. So that would be some suggestions that I would give to some of my patients.
And we also have another caller who said that they often, their team often says that they're dehydrated and they don't quite know why that happens and what that's all about. And I wondered if, Dr. Yonesh, if you could address that initially, just, and I'll probably have everybody address it, but the issue of just that somehow the issue of their fluid intake is problematic.
Yeah, it's some of these medications will give an individual a subjective sense that they are dry or dehydrated, and part of that can be the sensation in the mouth that's caused by the way the drug makes a person feel, and also just being on medication can sometimes make it harder for a person to drink. So as Joan was suggesting, taking frequent smaller meals every day, you know, what we advise individuals who are on these medications to do is to make sure that they take the time to have frequent smaller drinks of liquid during the day, and depending on how their taste buds are, find whatever it is that they are actually able to get down.
Excellent. And Dr. McDermott, did you want to add anything? Or?
I don't have much to add, except what I would say is that hydration is important in all patients, people with cancer on medication, as Dr. Yonesh and Joan have said. But what I would add is that it's even more important in most patients with kidney cancer, because when they're often dealing with one kidney. So preserving that function is very important, and you often end up having to drink to much more than you would normally to maintain that state of hydration. So it's often, quite a few cups of liquid a day, and the proper liquid that doesn't have, caffeine in it, maybe up to 8 cups or more of liquid a day. And the only way you really can do that is to keep it with you, on a regular basis. So you're taking small amounts over the course of the day, and ideally stopping it before you get too close to bedtime, so you're not up all night in the bathroom. That's a challenge. It's certainly not fun, but it's one of the things that our patients need to take very seriously.
And Joan, do you want to add anything to that?
Well, I guess I could also suggest, especially if you're not getting enough calories and your appetite isn't as well, sometimes by doing, the supplements or smoothies, sometimes that can kind of give you both calories, protein, and also fluid intake. So sometimes that's a little bit easier for people to take in, especially if they're having mouth sores or changes of taste. So by getting calorie-rich foods might help. And then, some of my patients really enjoy flavoring their water with mint or lemon or cucumbers or fruit, just to, because they feel that, water might not have a flavor to it. So if you kind of add to it, it might help a little bit as far as your fluid intakes. And, maybe even trying to do it in between meals, drinking a sip, every 10 minutes, 15 minutes. And like everybody has said, really just trying to, keep it with you and drink between meals. That usually helps.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank all of you. You're just wonderful speakers. You've really just it's been a phenomenal call and just covering such a wonderful array of topics regarding the progress in the treatment of renal cell cancer. So I want to thank all of you, not only for your expertise, but your compassion, your wisdom, your information has just been incredible. And I want to thank all of our online participants who actually sent us some really wonderful questions that all of you have been able to address, and all of you who've been listening as well. I do want to actually let you know that if you didn't get to ask a question, please do call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE. And I do want to remind you that this is a one-hour workshop, and that although we are about to conclude this workshop, the services that you can access from Cancer Care, those are endless. And I just want to review with you, we have a staff here of 60 master's level trained oncology social workers, and our services are free. and we offer individual support and counseling. We offer practical assistance and financial assistance. We also have support groups on the telephone and online, and we also talk to people on the telephone online as well. And we also have lots of materials and booklets and fact sheets and, of course, many of these workshops which you have information about in your materials. But most importantly, as we conclude today, I do not want anyone to feel that you are alone in coping with cancer. I want you to know that you're part of a community of support. You have lots of resources, of course, in addition to cancer care, but I specifically want to say that I really want you to feel that you're part of the cancer care community now and that you can contact us at any time and that we are here to help you. And so most importantly, although the program will soon end, your connection to us, that really hopefully will continue, that you will, you know, contact us if you have any particular needs or questions that we can address. I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.